From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, human rights groups plan to keep pressure on North Korea. Integration versus security poses dilemma for Southeast Asia. Cambodia looks at violence against children. These stories and more on this Friday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. This week, a top United Nations human rights investigator has held meetings with North Korean diplomats about a possible visit to assess the country's human rights practices. The negotiations come as North Korea tries to prevent the United Nations from referring the country's human rights situation to the International Criminal Court. Brian Patton reports from Seoul on reaction from human rights groups.
This week's meetings between human rights investigator Marzuki Darusman and North Korean diplomats followed Darusman's groundbreaking inquiry into the country's dire human rights situation. The United Nations Commission of Inquiry report issued earlier this year documents a network of political prisons in North Korea holding 120,000 people and a list of atrocities that include extermination, murder, enslavement, torture, imprisonment, rape, forced abortions, and other sexual violence. Joanna Hosianik, the Deputy Director of Citizens Alliance for North Korean Human Rights, cooperated with the UN investigator to detail the extent of abuse in that country. She says it is a widespread, systematic type of abuse based on a perceived level of loyalty to authorities in Pyongyang. Thousands of North Koreans can be labeled as hostile because other members of their family in the past either opposed or fell out of favor with the regime. They are then sent to forced labor camps to work 16 to 18 hours a day and given meager food rations.
Many prisoners die within the first year of being sent to the camp because it takes time for the body, as the prisoners say, to adjust to this hard work and adjust to this level of nutrition that they provide. It's not even nutritious food that they provide.
Phil Robertson, the Deputy Director for Asia at Human Rights Watch, says the UN Commission of Inquiry report shows a level of atrocities that has not been seen since the Nazi concentration camps in the Second World War, and one that requires a unified international response.
The fact that the Commission of Inquiry said very clearly that these are human rights abuses without parallel, you know, in the last 30 or 40 years, you know, indicates that the UN has to step back to its original purpose, which was to prevent crimes of mass atrocities.
Human rights groups have strongly endorsed the report's recommendation to prosecute North Korean officials, including leader Kim Jong-un, for abuses at the International Criminal Court. North Korean diplomats have denounced it as a collection of lies, fabrications, and smears. The UN General Assembly is expected to vote on the issue in the next month. Even if a majority of nations vote to prosecute North Korean officials, the measure is likely to be vetoed by China or Russia when it is sent to the UN Security Council. Still, Hosianik says the report has already succeeded in focusing world attention on human rights abuse in North Korea, and it has gotten the attention of North Korea, which is discussing the possibility of allowing a UN human rights investigator into the country for the first time, if the world body drops efforts to prosecute Pyongyang officials.
That this is what makes them move, that they very much are scared of this whole international community notion that they might be held responsible for those crimes.
Robertson says this is a good first step, but more needs to be done.
When there's real leverage, when there's a real threat to hold leaders accountable in North Korea, the government will react. But I don't believe for a second that we're seeing any sort of significant commitment to real rights-respecting reforms.
These activists say this is just the beginning of a strategy to keep increasing pressure on North Korea to change and send a message that officials involved in human rights abuses will be held accountable. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
The organization that conducts a standardized test used for college admissions in the United States is withholding test scores for thousands of South Korean and Chinese students over concerns of cheating. Educational Testing Service, which developed the Scholastic Aptitude Test, or SAT, said in a statement it has received specific, reliable information about possible cheating during tests given October 11th. The statement said the organization takes seriously any attempt to violate testing and security policies. It also strongly denounced organizations that seek to illegally obtain test materials for their own profit. Hope dwindled Thursday for finding survivors of a mudslide in Sri Lanka that the government called the country's biggest natural disaster in a decade. 15 people are confirmed dead after a wave of mud rushed into a village 192 kilometers from the capital, Colombo, Wednesday. Soldiers are continuing to dig through the debris for at least 100 missing residents. A high-level United Nations meeting Friday in Bangkok is expected to address how Southeast Asia's economic integration will lead to more transnational criminal activity and public security threats. VOA correspondent Steve Herman in the Thai capital reports on what officials say is needed to counter the problem.
Southeast Asia's planned economic integration in the coming years is hoped to boost economic growth by lowering barriers to trade and travel. But those measures are also expected to allow transnational criminal groups freer rein. The UN Office on Drugs and Crime says Asian authorities need to work together better to combat the problem. A recent UNODC report warns gaps between security agencies and economic transport planners leads to inefficiency and ineffectiveness at a time Southeast Asia is committed to regional trade integration. On Friday, senior officials from countries in Southeast Asia and the Pacific region, along with those of several UN development agencies, will meet to discuss the problem. The region's representative for UNODC, Jeremy Douglas, tells VOA the conference will bring together those involved in promoting trade and officials tasked with managing borders and enforcing rule of law.
We need to bring the thinkers that are involved in both together. We need them to appreciate each other, and we need to come up with some practical solutions that are going to help counter transnational crime.
Organized crime in Southeast Asia generates, by conservative accounts according to UNODC, about $100 billion per year. Douglas says illicit drug manufacturing and trade in such countries as Afghanistan, Laos, Myanmar, and Pakistan continues to grow and are destabilizing the region.
We also see the destabilizing effect of other things like human trafficking or other types of trafficking where money is generated, then get laundered into the legitimate economy. When they get laundered into the legitimate economy, they distort it. So basically, they hurt the people, the businesses that play by the rules.
The Association of Southeast Asian Nations has set December 2015 for achieving an integrated economic community. But the Asian Development Bank and other institutions have cautioned the community will fall short of its goals by the deadline because there are many issues and policies still to be resolved. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Myanmar President Thein Sein has called for a landmark meeting with representatives of the country's military, top political parties, and ethnic minority groups. The summit to be held Friday in the capital, Naypyidaw, will bring together six political parties, including that of longtime democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The meeting is the first of its kind and comes amid tensions as Myanmar, also known as Burma, emerges from decades of direct military rule. Cambodia has launched a United Nations-backed survey into violence against children that found most abuse is carried out by family or adult relatives. Ron Corbin reports for VOA from Bangkok.
The survey in Cambodia, part of a UN program on the extent of child violence, found emotional, sexual and physical abuse of children was rampant, with more than half of minors encountering some form of physical violence by age 18. The survey, with the backing of the Cambodian government, found a quarter of children were subjected to emotional abuse, often by parents or a close relative, while 5% of males and females reported sexual abuse as a child. UN Special Representative on Violence Against Children, Mata Santos Payes, says the survey's findings highlight how children often remain silent to abuse, an outcome that can perpetuate a cycle of violence into the next generation.
One important concern, just to illustrate, was the fact that more than 50% of girls and more than 90% of boys feel very hard to tell about situations of violence. They don't tell to anybody. They keep it to themselves. And the trauma just keeps growing. And this is one of the reasons why in so many places we see the intergenerational transmission of violence.
The survey was based on interviews of 2,500 Cambodians from 13 to 24 years old. Officials say it marked a major step in surveying the extent of abuse of children and young people. In Asia, Santos Peyes also met with the Lao government, which is carrying out a national action plan on violence against women and children. The plan, she says, will hopefully be backed by a new law now before the National Assembly, which could improve protections for children. The United States and Europe have conducted studies of violence against children and taken legislative measures to punish those responsible and help the victims deal with the trauma. Santos Peyes says countries in the Asia-Pacific region are now making gains in addressing those issues.
So the tip of the iceberg that we know about is very frightening, and it's not different from region to region. But in this particular region, we are encouraged by a number of factors. Most countries have been giving to this topic a very high attention in policies that are being put in place.
A report by the independent non-profit Copenhagen Consensus Center put the total global cost of child abuse, largely based on abuse at home, at $3.6 trillion, with the highest cost burdens in the Middle East and North Africa, South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. The costs are linked to treatment, interventions by social workers, recovery and reintegration of traumatized children or as victims of sexual violence, and medical treatments. But Santos Peyes says the global surveys of abuse of children within the family and in schools point to a long way to go into investigating the situation in institutions, ostensibly for the care and protection of children and those associated with the justice system. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
On the other side of the globe, in suburban Los Angeles, a mosque that began as a center for Muslim immigrants from Thailand now serves Muslims of many backgrounds. As Mike O'Sullivan reports from Azusa, California, the thriving religious center is a labor of love for one Thai immigrant and his family.
Rahmat Payakung wheels a cart of wood across the parking lot of this suburban mosque called Masjid Al-Fatiha. He is overseeing the remodeling of the structure that was once a medical clinic. His wife, Sukati, is sweeping the mosque courtyard. The muezzin makes the call to prayer as more than 200 worshippers gather midday Friday. Payakung is the administrator and imam of what is thought to be the first house of prayer established by Thai Muslims in the United States. They are a minority of a minority because most Thais are Buddhist.
So our people, our Thai people, friends and associates thought that it would be a good idea to establish a mosque so we can maintain our cultures and maintain our faith.
After 19 years, the mosque is international, and the hundreds who gather for prayer come from all parts of the Muslim world.
We have people from Pakistan, from India, from Philippines, Indonesia, Dubai, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Egypt, you know it all, African and African Americans and all walks of life and all kinds of people that come over here because this is an international place.
Rafiq Ahmed was among those who came to pray on a recent Friday. He moved to the United States from India by way of Pakistan. He credits the imam and his wife with building this community.
They are the backbone. they are so committed and they've been doing a wonderful job for the community.
Some Thai members of the mosque met recently to share a Thai meal, and longtime mosque member Mariam Runsawan reflected on the changes as the community has expanded.
The businessman helped for the money and everything. So now we are success that we have a big mosque and beautiful inside.
Rachmat Piyakun says there have been tensions with some in this mostly Christian neighborhood who are suspicious of Muslims.
However, we sustain and we, as the Quran taught us, that be patient, do good thing and good deeds. And that's why we've been lasting for 19 years.
The mosque has become a spiritual home for the Muslim community of this suburban neighborhood, where there was none before. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Azusa, California.
As we have for every Friday, we like to head out to the movies and see what's playing. And movies about women in peril have had a very long history. That theme is almost cliche, but as VOA's Ray Kugel tells us about a short film with a unique take on the old idea.
I had a dream last night. I was kidnapped and sold for spare parts.
You're not that old.
I don't know, Winona. I don't think I should be here.
A young, attractive woman with a suspicion that her life is in danger is the premise of a movie called Burning Hearts. Well, sort of. What happens at the end almost makes you forget about her. Elle is an anxious Ukrainian model working in Tokyo who takes a cab ride with a driver named Katsu, haunted by troubles of his own. He's just delivered a meditative interior monologue questioning himself about training and discipline and waiting for some kind of sign. It doesn't take long for him to find out. Elle fears she's being followed.
Everything good that's gonna happen has already happened. Everything is slowly going to get worse.
Maybe you just need a change, like a new haircut.
I know it. This sounds ridiculous.
And is dropped off at her girlfriend's apartment. She is an Australian model about to take on an assignment in Shanghai and discovered having an affair with Ed, Elle's American boyfriend. Elle finds Ed hiding on the balcony. Elle storms out into the street, is chased down by Ed, who grabs her and apologizes, but is rejected with a smack to the head. Elle breaks free, only to be accosted and roughed up by a group of Japanese yakuza. The taxi driver is still sitting in his car watching, and then takes matters into his own hands. This is when Burning Hearts leaves the soap opera behind and turns into an amazing martial arts action film. Katsu is a one-man wrecking crew fighting the Yakuza, but not at all the kind moviegoers are used to seeing with dizzying camera and sound tricks. There's none of that. This more than 5-minute sequence is completely different and one you will not forget. Australian-born James McFay wrote and directed Burning Hearts and makes the most out of the 14.5-minute film. I spoke with McFay about how the astonishing fight scene was done and the story's setup regarding how typical it is for foreign models to work in Tokyo and other parts of Asia.
It's very common. I mean, it's been happening for a long time, since the 80s and 90s. It's not as lucrative as it used to be, but, you know, they're everywhere. They're in China. They're in Thailand, they're in Taiwan. A lot of my research and then later on feedback came from models who'd been in places like Japan in the 90s and had done, you know, one commercial and then put down a deposit on a house. And it's obviously changed very, very much. I was there as a model in 2006. And I think, like a lot of other models there, we were just living on the poverty line, you know. We were never going to get rich when you're there. It wasn't a pretty life.
Is the film saying something more about the loneliness of foreign models working in Japan and elsewhere in Asia?
I don't think they really have a special loneliness. I think if you're young and you're by yourself and you're put in a foreign country, it's a universal feeling. A lot of the models, specifically who go to Asia, are often very, very young. And if they don't speak the language, it's very isolating. And Elle, the main character, is representative of that. But it's theoretical. She represents Europe. Her friend represents Australia because he's Australian, Winona. And then the boyfriend represents America. And then, of course, Katsu, the taxi driver, represents Japan. And for me, as an Australian, we were in a very privileged position to choose between whether we would either side with the U.S. or side with China. And as you can see in the film, Winona decides to go to China and abandon her boyfriend, America, and abandon her friend, Europe. And obviously Europe is just doesn't know what it's going to do and is sliding down a slippery slope. And Japan is somewhere on the fringes but has a very latent power.
The highlight of the film was the long fight scene between the cab driver and the gang of Yakuza. Was it done in one take?
Yeah, it's done in one take, but I think we did four takes. And some of the takes had better moments. The take we used was a fourth. And obviously in the first take, he was much more... he wasn't as exhausted as he is in this one, but I think this one had was probably technically the best.
How was the fight scene choreographed so well?
It was choreographed by Hirokatsu Kaito, who's a good friend of mine who I met. He has a stunt team called BOS, and we choreographed it... Well, he choreographed it, really, in his studio a few days before. And on the day, we kind of refined it. He's just an incredible talent. There were some things that I wanted to put in there that he wasn't sure about. Like, I wanted the bats and stuff, which is very video game. And the final kick that Katsu does to destroy the final boss.
Is there a greater message to Burning Hearts than just the rescue of a woman in distress?
It was a love letter to Japan and all my Japanese friends, especially the stuntmen, who are so humble and hardworking and just the most incredible people to have on a film set. In a way, it's very arrogant for me to say, you know, to Japan, you have so many more strengths than you give yourself credit for, but it's kind of what I'm saying.
McFay gets a tremendous performance out of Hidetaka Ichiyama as the heroic cab driver who is himself trained in karate, taekwondo, and gymnastics. Ichiyama is like a hungry lion who's escaped capture and won't be caught. Burning Hearts starts as a slow burn and then finds a cinematically unexpected way to reach its climax. You won't be disappointed. I'm Ray Kugel.
Ray tells us if you'd like to go see the movie, all you have to do is visit your favorite search engine and type in Beaufort.Asia. That's BEAUFORT.Asia. Well, we've been proud to bring you Daybreak Asia in its current form for more than 4 years. You know, Les Carpenter was the program's inaugural host, and I, along with my colleagues, have carried it on since Les retired at the end of 2011. In fact, my first outing on New Year's Day 2012 began with a computer breakdown. We had no audio available. And so my colleagues joined me right here in Studio 23 to recall collectively the biggest stories of the past year. And so Daybreak Asia has truly been a collaboration ever since. As the times have changed, so has the way this program comes to you, from shortwave radio and now to streaming on the internet via podcasts and affiliate stations who, by the way, we thank very much and we're proud to be featured on your broadcasts. Now we embark on yet another evolution of our existence. At this time each weekday, myself and Ira Melman will present VOA Global. Daybreak Asia will continue to be a prominent part of the new program, although in a condensed new package, and of course, available as a daily podcast. And you'll hear all of our other programs in that same format during VOA Global, including China Focus, International Edition, and many of our popular weekly features. You can hear them all daily on VOA Global, or subscribe to the ones that you enjoy the most as podcasts. No matter how you choose to listen, we're continuing to bring you the news, information, and features you've come to enjoy and ask for over the past several years. And while this concludes our 25-minute presentations of Daybreak Asia, the sun will continue to rise each day, and we'll be right here to greet it and you. Thanks for listening to Daybreak Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson. We'll meet again next week with VOA Global. The latest world news is coming your way next with Steve Norman and International Edition. Please stay tuned.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com.